today we are speaking with John again about the sex registry in America. For anyone, by the way, who notices a sound quality change, I'm recording from somewhere unusual with a different microphone than I normally use. So if that is bothersome to anybody, I apologize. Otherwise, thanks for coping with it. Hi, John.
Hi.
Thank you for being willing to jump on another call and talk about this.
Mm-hmm. Happy to be back.
Okay, great. I was hoping we could start with sort of an origin story of the sex registry, if that works for you.
Sure.
Okay, great. I just feel like it will help to give people sort of a background of where this all started and why it is in place today. So, Central Minnesota, 1989. And this is, you know, for landscape purposes, this is, think Stranger Danger and the Satanic Ritual Fear, and people both, you know, kind of waking up to things that they should be fearful of. And there's kind of just this general simmering panic about a few different topics in the community. Jacob Wetterling was an 11-year-old boy, and he was abducted while he was riding his bicycle. And the National Manhunt came up empty. Law enforcement was embarrassed, and they were unable to recover Jacob. And Jacob had this mother who was this really incredible woman, and she led a successful crusade that resulted in the Wetterling Act of 1994, requiring states to collect and publicly disseminate information on known sex offenders. But for a little more background, I'll say that I don't think that the initial intention of the registry was for it to be publicly accessible. I think the problem was that in this crime, there were law enforcement agencies that were not communicating with each other. And so, like, you know, county versus city, like, jurisdictional issues dictated that there was no central database for predators that they could, flag as being someone they should go speak to if there was an abduction. There was just a lack of communication. And what that led to was a failure of law enforcement to find these perpetrators and the perpetrator, you know, the abductor of her son. And I believe there's more information about this, by the way, on the podcast Getting Off, episode 18, Revenge of the Porn, Sex Crimes and Policy. It's a really, really good episode. I recommend anyone listening to this also listen to that, because it gets more into detail and provides a lot of really useful information. But anyway, they talk about how it was to do with Megan's Law at the legislative level when it was made, the decision was made to make this information publicly accessible. Mm-hmm. And right now, the U.S. is the only country that has a publicly accessible registry. You know, many other countries have registries, but they're just for law enforcement. So we're the only ones. Mm-hmm. And currently, there are more than 850,000 registrants. And Patty Wetterling, who's Jacob's mother, she has since reversed her position on the registry. She's spoken publicly about regretting her role in the registry's inception. She says that she's helped to create a public registry that is counterproductive in shaming and ostracizing individuals rather than helping them reintegrate into society. And by the way, for anyone more interested in that case, there's a good podcast about it specifically called In the Dark. So that's where the sex offender registry came from. And I think that it's interesting to me that it makes sense that it was a child-related crime that started this registry, because I think a lot of us, when we hear about registrants, we think of child predators. There is this association, there's this link there between child offenders and general sex offenders. And I think it's odd, to me, it's very strange that a registry that was designed with the purpose of protecting children has grown to, or evolved into, encompassing all sex offenders and omit offenders that harm children in ways that are non-sexual. So I think we took a weird turn somewhere. It initially started out as a child-focused entity. And by the time it was put into effect, it was a sex-focused entity. And so that's where I'm confused. I don't know why or how it evolved that way exactly. So that's my background.
Yeah, no, it is important that, because that it starts off, and these are like the stories, you know, Megan's Law and the Wetterling Law, and that they are about child crimes. And that was the big public push for it. And they've only ever expanded, you know, because it hasn't, you know, there's not like media attention every time, like, you know, nobody notices when they add more and more kinds of crimes to the list, and it varies by state. But states have only ever, to my knowledge, I mean, maybe there's a few exceptions, but expanded what the registrable offenses are. And part of it too is that it is made mandatory for certain kinds of offenses, even things that aren't strictly sexual in nature. I think kidnapping is like a really good example. You know, there it is plausible that you can kidnap a child to sexually abuse them. But it is also, there's other motives for kidnapping kids too. Like it's a family member and you're trying to get like ransom money or something like that. Should that be a registrable offense? It should be a crime, you know, and that needs to be handled in its way. But is it something, and that when you take discretion away from a judge, you know, and a judge might be able to say, and this is interesting too, because it gets into the kind of the punitive sort of sentencing kind of a thing. But if there was a way for a judge to be able to ex include or exclude somebody from a registry, but there's isn't. It's that if you get convicted of a crime, of this exact crime, and it doesn't, and just like every sort of other thing in the criminal justice system too, is that it really ignores the individual circumstances. And that is kind of the one of the big things about making things, you know, quote unquote, mandatory minimums or mandatory addition to the sex offender registry, is that it really excludes, or it just it when you include everybody, and this is something too, and you make it impossible to appeal to get off. You know, you can't ever get off, no matter what happens, no matter what the nature of your crime was, or no matter what you do in the next 20 years, that if it's a lifetime registration, then you just never get off, because the idea is that the threat kind of remains the same throughout the entire someone's life,
It doesn't
which
allow for rehabilitation or reintegration.
it assumes it actually it's worse, because it's not that it doesn't allow for it assumes that it is impossible. It assumes that rehabilitation is impossible.
There are a lot of crimes that confuse me as to whether they're registrable or not. For example, like we've heard about relatively or comparatively innocuous crimes getting you on the registry, such as public urination, flashing your breasts, having, if you're 18 and you have sex with a 17-year-old, in some states, that is a sex offense, and that'll get you on the registry. Also, I think it's interesting that there isn't like a
Sexting
viol
now too, like, you know,
oh,
sending,
oh
you know,
yeah.
high schoolers. There was just actually a story in my local newspaper about how, you know, my city's changing its sex. They, you know, the city wants to do something about all the high schoolers text or sexting each other. And part of the threat is, well, you could wind up on the sex offender registry if, you know, you send somebody, you know, an inappropriate, you know, image of you. You know, a child pornography, you can call that. You know, a 16, so that's child pornography. And so like and it's that it's a threat. You know, don't send those pictures to your friends or what, you know, whomever. And it's not, you know, not to make light of it too, but it's part of like the threat. You know, it doesn't say like you ought to, like this is should be something that everyone needs to know about and be registerable. It's just as that part of the punishment is that you'd have to register as like a child pornographer.
Yeah, and if you are a child, if you are a minor and you take a naked photo of yourself and send that out, then you have just committed a crime and you essentially made yourself your own victim and you could be, you could get
Isn't that
yourself on the
crazy?
registry.
Yeah, isn't that something? And so again, it's the lack of discretion. Like, who actually thinks, like, let's say, like, I think that if you could really decide, and the legal system is not set up for this at all, but in, you know, another world, if you could, you know, have people actually look at all the facts and like really determine, really do assessments, really kind of do kinds of things and determine whether or not someone should be registered or should be able to come off the register. You know, if you could actually pull that off. But the thing is, that would take a lot of time and that and money and people power that the justice system just can't handle. You know, when the justice system gets overwhelmed, which happens, it does very, it implements very dumb policies to sort of make it, to make the justice system more efficient is kind of a, so it, it, you know, it, it, you want to take individual circumstances into account, but that gets really, really difficult when you're talking about these like big legislative projects.
Right.
Like the registry.
Right.
That aren't legal. That's the other thing too. You know, legal experts didn't make the sex offender registry, and you know, victim advocates' rights did not come up with this idea. A bunch of senators did, and a bunch of politicians did. You know, they don't know, you know, like where what really to expect, and they, you know, they've been shown that they use faulty, you know, data that's been shown not to be accurate, or at least like flimsy.
Yeah.
And so,
I can understand too. Like, think about that. It was 1989. Well, I guess the Wetterling Act was passed in 1994, but still, at that time, you know, people were thinking this was a child protective measure. And I think that politicians had a great opportunity to curry favor with their constituents by really pushing for this registry. That
right. Watch everybody come together like to save children. I mean, you
right.
can't get better than that in politics. Like, everyone gets along. People love it when like the Democrats and Republicans like agree on a policy.
Right.
That's like really popular.
Yeah,
usually.
And banding together against like child harm is a very good way to do that. Yeah. Absolutely. So
And that's not to say that Congress should not have done anything about crimes against children. That's not to say they don't have a role. It's just like, what are you going to do? What is the problem that you're trying to solve?
And what's the best way to solve it? Like, how are we going to implement this the smartest way possible and the most effective way possible? And to that end, that kind of leads me to my next question, because I know a few people I've spoken to who are in favor of the registry and think it's important. And I know that must be a common opinion. So let's, you and I, imagine the way that the registry is supposed to be or is best used. And let's just like imagine how this is a useful thing and how it could be good for our society and our communities. And then we can talk about whether or not the registry is like currently designed to achieve those goals.
Do that.
What'd you say?
Yeah. Well, like what are like, yeah, does the registry even like do
yeah,
these things?
Do
so, I mean, it, and you know, I think in its purest form, I mean, I think it's for like parents of young children. I mean, those are the reasons that you hear for a registry is like parents with kids. Like if we had known that there was somebody across the street from us who has already been convicted of child
molestation and abuse,
and like, or like abuse or whatever, that we could have stopped it. You know, that's
right.
Kind of like one thing. Like we would have not, you know, we would have kept like a better eye on, you know, the guy across the street and told our, you know, kid not to talk to them.
And the people I spoke
to, makes sense.
They have small kids. And so I can understand how it's a personal issue for them. Like they want that awareness. And so I understand where that comes from for sure. So I guess maybe it's best used in that case for vetting neighborhoods in like residential neighborhoods or school routes. If you're thinking about letting your kids walk to school, you know, it's funny. I was also thinking recently about whether as a woman, because the registry is not child focused or not child centric. Well, maybe I don't know. It's not child exclusive. So do I or could I benefit from the registry as a woman? So I'm thinking, okay, well, if I'm single and I'm on dating sites and I'm going out on a blind date with someone I've never met before, I guess I could check the registry to see if he's a registered sex offender. And maybe if he's, you know, a habitual rapist or something, I might decide not to go on the date with the guy. That's a lot of unique circumstances to make this narrative plausible. But the immediate thought I had following that narrative in my mind was that, well, I think it might be more likely. I mean, I would be more inclined for that type of registry if there was like a domestic violence registry where I could see if someone, you know, was abusive in relationships and whether that's something I could be on the lookout for. Like, not necessarily someone who's a sexual offender, but someone who is just guilty of domestic violence, or specifically if it's a repeat offender of a domestic violence issue, then that's someone I'd absolutely want to stay away from. So I've kind of jumped the gun in already starting to tear up the registry and how it's best used. But anyway, yeah. So I guess you could say that women vetting blind dates who want to see if they're dating someone who's ever sexually assaulted anybody, that could be a useful method. But I've never done that. I don't know anyone who's ever done that either.
Oh, no, people definitely do that. So yeah, people do that. So that's the thing with, like, I mean, it's publicly available. I mean, you just don't know who's looking. And it's not just like the registry. I mean, all you have to do is Google someone's name. That's the first thing that shows up about them. You know what I mean? So yeah, no, that makes sense. I think that the trouble is, and this is just something that the registry doesn't account for and the legal system wants to account for, but it just hasn't yet. And this is just kind of weird to say, but it is that it just accounts for, cannot account for people that their experience with, like, the criminal justice system actually does change their attitudes and does, like, change their, and they actually are, like, let's say, like, rehabilitated after their experience. So that's what I mean by it assumes that you cannot be rehabilitated. Is that, let's say, some, you know, you look up somebody, you know, before you go on a blind date, and you do see that they have a sexual assault charge on their record from, you know, 18 years ago.
Right.
Like, do you go on, like, the date with that person?
I would.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people would not.
Right. And so it just, because the registry, again, so if it's a safety thing, it does not actually account for how safe, like, you are, like, with a person. Like, it like, you know that they have this conviction, but you cannot know how dangerous that person is years after the fact.
Yeah, and I think, for me, I think that's something that would make the registry more effective at recognizing truly dangerous or potentially dangerous individuals is if it had some sort of cognition of repeat offenders or habitual offenders or just like anything more than a one time. Because for me, if I hear someone has done something one time, I think, what were the circumstances? You know what I mean? Like, and how much time has passed? And is there a pattern here? Or is this like, was this a horrible mistake someone made one time? Because I don't think that anyone who makes, I mean, of course it depends on the mistake. If you're like, you know, murdered, whatever. I don't want to get derailed. I'm just saying that I think that I believe in the power of rehabilitation. And I think that if someone makes a mistake, if someone violates someone on one occasion and then truly regrets it and takes accountability and shows remorse, then that person shouldn't necessarily be labeled as a violator for the rest of their lives. Like, that shouldn't be all that they are and all that they're reduced to. And so for me, the fact that the registry doesn't take into account the number of offenses is problematic.
Yeah. So a few years ago, I was watching on public TV. It was like on the internet, though, that we were having a Supreme Court election in my state. And so I'm kind of a nerd like this. So I was watching the debate between these two individuals who wanted to be, they were running for election to be voted onto the Supreme Court of my state. And there was like a left-wing one and a right-wing one, you know, for just to simplify things, I guess. But The one on the left was trying to be to kind of like do like a tough on crime kind of stance, you know, for probably, you know, for the political reasons kind of. And that judge sort of pointed to another one of the other judge's decisions, and was basically trying to make a, you know, this judge, you know, on the right, still soft on crime. No, I'm the real tough one, actually. And in just a brilliant sort of like debate jujitsu, the right-wing judge made a point to address that attack and said, you know, I'm actually really troubled by something that the first judge said, which is that they would never see someone willing to change, and said, as a judge, you have a responsibility to believe that the justice system works and that people can change. And it was like a great kind of moment. And that judge actually went on to win the election. It was kind of interesting because I was like, oh, that was like a great, it was just like a little great sort of underappreciated thing. And that judges should care about that. And the legal system should care about that. And when we don't care about that, and we think that people can't change, and that the justice system, and we just assume that the, you know, that the criminal justice system could be used for a force for good, for positive change, for actual positive change in people's lives. You know, yeah. we just don't think of it like that at all. And so it just is, you know, I think that judge, you know, believed it also was sort of a political kind of thing, and they were just trying to make the other judge look bad in the debate, kind of. But you know, they really stood up for this idea that people can change. And I think that the legal system sort of commitment to like psychological stasis, you know, like you do a violent crime or something, like when you're 19 or whatever, you know, you age out of those kinds of behaviors. And to label somebody, even if it's on the registry, if it's just felony status, you know, like, because, you know, those kinds of, you know, arrest records and things, like, those are public records too. So it's all kind of like the public access of these things. It just assumes that people can't change. And that's part of the popular culture too. That's part of the popular narrative about sex offenders, is the inability to change. You know, these people will never change.
Yeah.
So that's really super popular. And that, I think, is like a super big, that's another just really big, like, sort of ideological flaw that kind of manifests itself in these really bad ways, when we have to, again, be willing to let people change for positive.
Absolutely. I'm a huge, huge proponent of, like, for young boys and girls, consent education classes. And I think, too, that the best chance we have of seeing change in you know, adulthood post conviction is like education, classes, therapy, all of these things that will help people reintegrate back into society. And like a point you made on our previous talk was, how do we eliminate the antisocial behaviors in these people, and how do we make them more social, you know, how can we get them to be more social individuals? Because criminality is in itself, in, you know, antisocial behavior. So I think that those are our avenues for creating positive change.
Yeah, I agree with you. It just is really hard to do, because right now I just think that the criminal justice system does not create positive change. You know, like, you talk to the people who move through the criminal justice system, you hear very few stories. They exist, but about how, you know, like, their time in prison or whatever was a good thing for them, and that know, like, their role through the criminal justice actually did help them to like change, turn their life around. And that can happen, but we need to figure out how to do that more and do that better, and make the justice system, you know, make the function of the justice system people making their lives better and becoming better people, you know, the kind of people who don't victimize others. You know, that should be the goal of the criminal justice system, and it's not. It's punitive. So that's the other thing. You know, the goal of justice system is not rehabilitation, though all we want to say it, you know, our actions speak louder than our words, and we are very punitive. We just like to punish people as opposed to actually help them become the kind of person who's not going to do what they did again.
Right. Yeah. And I think that that speaks to a very instinctive nature in all of us, where if someone does something that we deem horrible, and I can think of several offenses I deem horrible off the top of my head, there is this primitive instinct alive in me that wants to like see that person pay for it. You know what I mean? And I think that the laws we pass that don't necessarily achieve our goals in the most effective way possible, they're answering that other need of ours, which is the primitive satisfaction.
That is like, that's the easy one,
Yeah.
I think. And, like I, kind of mentioned before, politicians got, they got a lot of credit for doing this. This was like a good thing. Like they got a lot of like political, like acumen for like joining together and passing this like awesome piece of legislation. But it doesn't do the kinds of things that it needs to do to actually do the kind of changes that I think we all want to see in society,
Right.
So they all got the credit and really didn't do like the hard work, in my view. It was really low-hanging fruit and something that was really easy. It's just, it's really easy to identify, we found the dangerous people. Like we've already, we did the work, like we found the dangerous people for you. We've identified them. Here they are. You don't have to be afraid anymore. This gets to another point I wanted to make earlier, actually, was in that the registry doesn't make, and you're talking about this adult woman who, going on a blind date or whatever, is that person actually when doing the registry? So people get sexually, date rape happens regularly. How many people that are, how many assailants of those date rapes are on the registry?
Right. Yes. Yeah,
So
I see your
like,
point.
are you being made more safe by look? And then like I said, so this person was on the, had a sexual assault charge on their record, 18 years ago or whatever. So I think that they are at a higher risk of sexually abusing me. That's the like that would be the thought. Like that's the risk, by that person on there. But you don't think that with just like this stranger, like they don't have a record. You still don't know. But the way that we charge these things, if they've ever done anything that you'd be afraid of, or if they're likely to do it to you. So it's like we, it's, it is an illusion of safety. It is not actually, in my view, and
Yeah,
yeah,
and I'm going to
we
break
want,
that down a
the
little bit
feeling of
more.
safety.
Yeah, because I, like, say I'm a single woman moving to a neighborhood and I want to know whether or not this neighborhood is safe. So I get on the registry and I look up how many offenders are in that area. And, maybe I have two options. Option A is filled with registrants and option B has no registrants. So I move to option B and I feel safer in my day-to-day life walking around at night because there are no registered sex offenders in my area. But the truth is, we hear about I'll use the most commonly cited statistic, which is 1 in 3 women. And again, that's, I guess, kind of sexist to, but anyway, being assaulted over the course of their lives. And we also spoke in our last talk about the ubiquity of sexual assault and how it's everywhere. Like it happens to so many people all of the time, and it's continuously happening. And we just
Even when
haven't,
they don't know it.
yeah, and we don't wrap our brains around the ubiquity of this thing, of sexual assault and battery. And what it is. And so, but the people, the actual rape itself, how often does that occur by someone stranger jumping out of the bushes and leaping on you or pushing you into a van and raping you there, this person you've never seen or met before? How often is it actually a stranger rape? Like, if that does happen, those people do attack and the home intruders do exist and those things happen, but it's so, comparatively speaking, it's so fractional compared to the amount of acquaintance rape that occurs.
Oh, definitely.
So I don't, I think that moving to neighborhood B might give you a false sense of security in that regard. That doesn't mean you're not going to be assaulted. It means you're,
Well, it means that you're moving into a nicer neighborhood. I'll tell you another thing about those, you'll notice about those red dots or like whatever kind of things is that they are in the poorer neighborhoods. So those neighborhoods hate that. There's a problem in my city right now too, where there's like a part of town that they feel like they are just getting these released sex offenders dumped on them. Like that's like the language. Because it's the only neighborhoods that they can afford to live in. So it's a poor neighborhood.
Right.
So that's another thing about having, like, you know, when you have, whether or not you're on the registry or not, but you have a criminal history, I mean, your financial potential is just hits the floor, kind of. And so, like, you know, you have to live in the poor, unless you have, you know, family things or you've got money from somewhere else. But if you're, like, on your own, I mean, it gets really hard to be, like, financially stable. Everything becomes a lot more difficult. So you have to move to the poor neighborhood.
Right.
Where they will actually rent to you. That's another thing. I mean, you know, that neighborhood, you know, if it's the kind of, like, rental companies that, you know, care. And, you know, there's places you can't rent if you have felonies. Like, they will just do the background check on you, and they'll just throw – that are in high demand.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's it varies from state to state. So there's like legislation about like discrimination on people with criminal histories that is kind of moving through places and whatever. But, you know, by and large, they don't want to rent to you. Like, like housing companies are trying to not rent.
Right.
You know. Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, to anyone listening, like, we are so firmly in the camp of, like, let's make smart decisions to decrease crime and decrease the recidivism of crime, mm-hmm. and to protect children and everyone, not just children, everyone. Mm-hmm. But I think I still keep coming back to this odd phenomenon of a public registry existing that encapsulates all styles of sex offenses, including those against children. But for example, if there's someone who is a foster parent and they have a kid and they beat that kid and then they do the same, you know, they're a habitual child, you know, abuser just physically, and there's no sex involved, I don't know. I guess it would vary state by state, but I don't know if that person would ever be registered if there's no sexual component there. I mean, it is a sex registry. So I'm a little bit baffled by the way that we've chosen to alienate sex offenders when we don't alienate other types of violent offenders.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we do alienate different, you know, people with criminal histories, just as not as overtly. It's like the website things. I mean, I think with like the registry too, like in particular, is that it's like designed to be isolating. Like, it is designed to make people afraid of you. Like, it is designed, like, to scare people away from you because you are an unsafe, like, we've identified an unsafe individual, so avoid them. I mean, that's the message.
Right.
So, again, this is, like, the antisocial thing. It's just as, like, on steroids. Like, the stigma is just on steroids because it's, you know, the government, you know, people trust the government to make good decisions. And there's just this idea, too, that, like, people wouldn't wind up on the registry unless they were dangerous, unless they were a threat to public safety. You know, they just... And that is just widely accepted, without really understanding, and just to say, like, you know, I hate, you know, oh, that's just more nuanced, and it's a gray area, and it's, you know, I don't, that's like way oversimplifying it, and I just, I don't know, I kind of want to avoid those cliches, to be honest with you, but
sure.
We just have to, yeah, make smarter decisions and realize that as a tool of public safety, I think it is a tool of like the perception of public safety as opposed to actually making society a safer place. I think that, you know, we've got to wait and see. This is still like a young kind of like experiment. I think this is still like a young experiment. So we're still kind of like seeing where this is all going to go. But I have a belief that we're actually making society less safe because, you know, the more that you isolate people, especially people that have already, you know, been convicted of a crime, have already done something. And then you just take those people and you isolate them more, like you cut them more off from society. I mean, that's the exact opposite of what we know is going to make people less likely to reoffend.
Right. Yeah, like it's not the best method to reduce future criminal behaviors if we
No.
are if we are.
So then what's the point?
Yeah. I don't know. I'd like to do more research and listen to more podcasts about the
Podcast, it's a new research.
it is the new research. Just about statistics, like I want to know how many people. I tried to do some research before this, but I found a lot of conflicting information. It was hard finding the exact statistics I was looking for. But I want to know,
They
like
probably
how,
don't exist, yeah.
right, like how many are repeat offenders, and how many are offenders that, you know, committed this type of crime on the registry
Yeah,
versus
I
the,
mean, crime
yeah.
statistics are just like notoriously difficult to figure out. I mean, yeah, it just is. It's a really big problem, sort of just like methodologically. Like, you know, there's you know, criminologists like rack their brains on how to like figure out actually how much crime is out there. I mean, that's just as like that's like what like a lot of criminologists do. And it's really difficult because, you know, people lie on, people don't tell the truth on surveys. Either they're lying or they don't understand. And, you know, and you can, you go to the legal system, but we know that the legal system has all these huge gaps that people don't really get scooped up when they, you know, if everybody who could, did a prosecutable crime got prosecuted, I mean, there would be good data in that, but that's definitely not what happens.
It's definitely not. And in fact, that kind of speaks to the whole Me Too movement, because the Me Too movement to me is about saying, oh yeah, that happened to me too, and I didn't say anything because, you know, it was some
Yeah.
kind of acquaintance style violation that occurred. And so it's all about waking people up to the fact that, hey, Jason from, you know, my chem class or from work, like
Yeah.
that thing you did to me, that was a violation. That was assault, and maybe you just don't know it, but I want to bring your attention to that now. Like it's about
Yeah.
people drawing attention to acquaintance assault rather than the people who commit felonies and be registered. You know what I mean? It's not. I would hate to see the Me Too movement, which I think is really valuable and beautiful, and I would hate for to see that wind up, you know, shaming registrants more, who are people who have committed an act and have paid their debt to society and are trying to reintegrate into society and better their lives. And
Yeah.
yeah.
I think about the, just to comment on like the Me Too movement, I think that the Me Too movement is like, I mean, it has been self-critical and self-reflexive. I mean, there's lots of like lively debate about what it's about and healthy too. And so, but I think that, I think, so it's good. I think that there's like a lot of really thoughtful people that are organizing around these issues. And so I don't really see a movement to like stigmatize people that are on the registry or, you know, things like that. Like, I don't think
Right.
that that's what it's about it. So I don't really see that, but there's definitely the possibility that it like eventually, like if the right, you know, if the people decide like what the policy is on the other side of it, it's like we need more of these people in prison and on the registry. I think if it becomes like a tool of like the mass incarceration has been good for society movement, like that could happen. I don't think that that's what's happening, but that's plausible. For it to become like a part of like the a cheerleader for mass incarceration, which I don't think that's what's happening, but that is definitely, I think, an issue that needs to be looked out for.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right, and it is being thoughtfully discussed in the media. I and the Me Too movement alone, I think, is just broadening our understanding of what consent means, which is great.
Totally.
That's a very worthwhile conversation to have. And on that positive note, is there anything else that you would like to add before we sign off?
Well, I just kind of making the one more point that I kind of mentioned before about this experiment that we're doing. I think it is an experiment. I think that you know, social scientists, I think historians are gonna have interesting things to say about, you know, because there was a lot of fear about crime in the 90s, like when this was passing. You know, it was the drug laws too. I mean, it was a lots of things. It wasn't just, you know, Megan's Law that that got passed during the 90s, there was a whole bunch of, you know, the federal government got super involved in crime issues, and increasingly, like, since whatever. And so I think when they came up with this new idea, it's just unprecedented.
Yeah.
We have never had, there's been, you could stigmatize someone, you know, in the old days, you know what I mean? And they did, you know, this is very old, you know, that people get ostracized in society. But the whole, let's put it on the internet and put their people's addresses and their faces and like their work locations, just like on the internet, like that's new. Like no one's ever done that before.
Yeah.
So we don't know like how this is gonna, like what kind of consequences this is gonna have. So it does sort of feel like I am just being, you know, I think it's a way to think about it, that I feel like I'm just kind of part of just some crazy experiment that we're just are gonna have to see how this all shapes up. Because we don't know yet. You know, we don't know. We have hypotheses, but we don't really have conclusions about whether or not this is like a good idea as to do as a society and as a country.
Yeah. I mean, the registry, what, was enacted in 94. So I guess pretty soon we'll be able to look and examine and see whether or not there's been a you know,
reduced crime rate. Well, I mean, it's 25 years. Result. I mean, let's say it sticks around. Like, let's say it's in effect for 100 more years.
Okay.
Let's say, like, what is it going to look like then? Like, how many people are going to be on it? There's all kinds of like interesting, like how this is going to grow. The other thing about the registry with like the internet as like this tool too is that the internet, once you make the databases, it's easy to add people onto a database. It's a lot more difficult to like build a new prison. So the registry isn't bound by like those sorts of constraints. Like you just keep on adding and adding and adding and adding, and it's, I mean, you need a lot of people to like maintain it and whatever. But as a solution,
especially if the registry could ever be used by the state as some sort of leverage when negotiating pleas, you know, like I don't know if that's. Then I can see how that would just continue to increase the number of registrants because it's being used at that point strategically and not ultimately because to its purpose to, you know, increase public safety.
I mean, yeah, I mean, there's a few things. I mean, because it's, as like a negotiating thing, but it, you know, that's not like conscious. Again, it's just as because it's mandatory. So it's because it's mandatory is why, you know, they don't have to negotiate about that, really. At least it is in my state. I'm not sure. Different states are just, it's going to vary because it's, yeah.
Right.
So that adds a lot of people on, and then it's like lifetime registry, 25 years, 15 years, 10 years, you know, whatever. And there's no, you know, those are just arbitrary numbers too. I mean, there's nothing that says, oh, we've done this such assessment and we think that this person's going to be dangerous for these more many years and then they can come off. It just is.
Right. And there's no way for a registrant to do self-work and, you know, pay their own way and take therapy and then apply to be removed from the registry after they've done that work. And there's no avenue for them to remove themselves from the registry and to stop being identified as a dangerous person, no matter how much work they put into it.
Another weird thing about this registry thing, too, with the internet in particular is, so when I come off, it'll be in, you know, a few more years I've got on, and then... But so let's say I'm quote unquote no longer registered. It's already on the internet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's already on the internet. So I'm not going to have like my picture taken anymore. I'm not going to have to, you know, I actually have my current address. I'll just move, you know, but it still is on the internet. Like all the other stuff is still on the internet. So yeah, it's just going to be a really interesting.
So yeah, even when you're
and that's going to be a legal issue. People are going to sue over that for sure. And so that'll go through the courts, you know. You know, I'm not supposed to be on the registry, and yet, you know, you could make like a private database. If somebody wanted to make like a private database and just collect all the, you know, there's already websites. There's already private websites that like mugshot.com or something like that. Like, so that's, you know, that's not run by the government. Mm-hmm. You know, they in a way, they, you know, they exploit public records, kinds of things too. But, you know, So this is going to be really interesting to see
Yeah.
where this all goes. And like I said, I think we're doing an interesting experiment here. And I don't think that it's going to be viewed too sympathetically in the future when people really kind of find out what's actually been happening on the ground.
Right. And again, I think that this is all well-intentioned, but I'm not sure that it's actually, well,
It just depends. There's a lot of actors involved. Some people are well-intentioned, some people I don't think are well-intentioned.
right. But the purpose behind the registry is to make people safer, and I don't know if it is.
Yeah, if we wanted to make people safer, like I really think, yeah, you talked about public education or just education, you know, sex education. It's so huge, and that
So
we have to like
important.
reverse so many of like these cultural things. And so there's lots of things that we could do to make people safer. And the registry seems like something that was designed not to make people safer, but to make people feel safer. That there's people who, you know, don't worry, we've already we're that you know, the government's doing something about this. The politicians are doing something about this very serious problem. You can tell because it's all over the internet. And I think that it makes us kind of feel good sometimes.
Yeah. I imagine if the funds that went toward, or the go to maintaining the registry, if those were reallocated toward sex education and consent awareness and public programs that really,
Even
dove into
rerouting, let's just
that.
think of all the money that is just wasted on, I think it's wasted on prisons.
Yeah.
And I mean, it just is huge. I mean, we are so willing to spend so much money on incarceration and punishment, and so unwilling to spend money on education and healthcare, you know, mental health care.
Yeah, that's a huge problem that needs addressing. Mental health and the amount of government resources that are allocated to it. Because you look at the homeless population, and now we're way off the rails, but there's so much mental illness and homelessness, and it's just not being addressed at all, and it really breaks my
Oh
heart
man.
to even.
And in crime. I mean, and crime and homelessness. Crime and homelessness and mental illness. I mean, that's all one issue, too. No, it's all connected. And so it's really, you know, we're just in the middle. There's a lot to sort out. And there's never going to be a silver bullet. And that's what kind of bugs me about the registry, too, is that it's people almost it was treated like a silver bullet to like combat this. And it's so lacking in a
Yeah.
basic theory of what's going on, and doesn't even, you know, execute well. So it's
Yeah, I think that to that point, the silver bullet, when the registry was designed, I think people would expect to open up the public registry or a map and see, oh, this person in this neighboring town or these three people in my county are dangerous, so I need to, adjust my life to take that into account. Meanwhile, if anyone goes onto the registry and they look at, well, not if anyone, but I did it the other day just for research. It's like, and what I continue to hear about people who have done this, it's like it's overwhelming the amount of registrants that are in your area. It's overwhelming. And so it makes it too cloudy, too complicated, too scary to actually make any positive adjustments in your life. I guess if you have a small child and there's someone directly across your street and you're able to see their criminal record and understand that's, you're uncomfortable with that, that's one way it can go. But by and large, I think that it's not very effective as a tool.
Yep, I suspect that you might be right about that. But
And I'm
yeah,
sure a
just
lot of
as
people disagree with us, and that's okay.
well.
I'm sorry if any of this has offended anybody.
Well, that's okay. I mean, it is what it is. That's
It is what
yeah.
it is.
But I mean, it's a political problem, I think, is at the end of the day too, and there's going to be a lot of disagreement about how best to handle those things. And you know that, you know, the means by which we kind of try to solve these big problems is like through politics. And so that's really hard too.
Thank God we have such a great president to lead us right now, then. I shouldn't have said that because I don't know if there are any Trump supporters that listen to my podcast, and I don't want to be a dick.
Oh, I'm sure.
But I've had
Oh,
a
I'm sure.
cocktail during this interview, so that happened. That happened. Before we go, just for anyone curious, because I know I was, can you walk us through what the experience of being on the registry is actually like? Like, what is it that you've had to do, and what is it that you continue to have to do to be on it?
So to be on the registry, the main thing is that like when you move or you have any sort of like change in job or change in school, I mean they want to know like a bunch of weird things. Like you have to call this hotline basically, and then they they send you a form in the mail. You just have to, the main thing is you fill out this form in the mail, and it really just comes like once a year. So the things that like you actually do, and then this past summer, I had to go and get my picture taken, and it's not on like a schedule or anything. I think that they just kind of like rotate through, and so it's probably gonna be like every few years I have to have like an updated picture, and they just, they send me something in the mail and like let me know. So like the actual of like what you have to do is pretty just boring. You have to like pay the fees. I mean, you have to pay for it. To like be to, the registry fees are come out of, the registrants pay all that.
I didn't actually know though. So you have to pay for all of it, all of the costs associated with you being on the registry. You're
It's,
charged personally for that.
yeah, I'm charged personally like an amount, and I'm not sure if it's all or like whatever. I mean, it's definitely something. I don't know where all the money goes. I mean, they obviously aren't needing to tell me that. It's like there's gonna be taxpayer funded too, but that's a no, that's like a big important kind of movement happening in criminal justice is like, they've been putting like the financial burden of the justice system onto the people that go through the system for like whatever and are convicted and whatever all the different stages. And so yeah, they put the costs onto the people. There's you have to pay for your cell in some places, so it's they've kind of moved that around. So yeah, you do have to, I do have to literally pay for it. And like probation too, you have to pay for being on probation and things like that.
I mean, what
So but
does it
then
affect you day to day? I mean, what, yeah.
So it's kind of funny. I think one thing that people are kind of curious about is, well, because it's public, you are sort of can be targeted for like vigilante sort of things. But one thing I will say, I've never had that, personally. Someone, nothing like that. I've never been harassed about it. And in fact, the biggest, you don't want to call him a harasser, but like the most annoying troublesome thing about it is the government. It's like sometimes I feel, it's like you get this like letter from like the government, and it's like, from the state of, wherever, and it's like, you have to fill all this out, and it's got your place of work, it's got like where you volunteer, your car that you drive, license plate number, driver's license number, all of they want all of like your social media like passwords, like in logins. Isn't that crazy? Oh yeah. Yeah. So again, that's just like registered thing. It doesn't have to be like an internet crime at all, but they just
Well,
want to know like
wait,
who
if
you're.
you so if you open up a new social media account, do you have to report that?
Technically.
Wow.
I mean,
Okay,
I
that is thorough.
and maybe that wouldn't be like enforceable by law, 'cause again, there's things that they can, they can send you out a form, and like if you volunteer that information too. You know what I mean? So some of it's it just it's
Honor
all
system.
very sticky legally.
Yeah, I imagine that that kind of minute detail that's required in terms of self-reporting is difficult for them to keep track of. How could they possibly have the
Oh,
resources to
how could they
monitor
possibly?
everyone's social media accounts
No,
on
they'd
the
have to hire like a
registry?
private investigator for every individual.
Right.
Or like not a private investigator, but they'd have to have like a detective on the case, like of every person,
Yeah,
which they're not definitely not doing. It's a lot of work to maintain, so it's not even. I mean, how do you even know if it's being maintained properly? I mean,
right.
that's a yeah, yeah. So there's that, but the actual like day-to-day things, it's much more like when you're applying for an apartment, when you're trying to get a new job, like when you, It's those main things. So it's the people who like you don't meet like in your personal life who, you know, you can just find out about, you know, people who are trying. Does that make sense? Like it's the people that you don't know,
yeah,
who don't know you, and like might recognize, you know, if they whatever look up. I had a friend, a coworker once, I lent her a book, and her had just my name in the front cover, and she took it home, and one of her kids just Googled my name because they just saw in the book and just didn't know who I was. So they just Googled it and like found out. And then they asked their mom. She had already known about it. So like, that's lucky. But wow. It's like, no, it just is. Yeah. So well, just like whatever. So it's like, you literally don't know who knows. So I will think another kind of thing about personal thing about the registry is that when you just don't know who knows and that, you know, that there's just people there must be a bunch of people out there who have seen it, you know, whether or not like they're a regular at like a restaurant or like a coffee shop that I go to, you know, and they've just randomly seen, like, it could just be anybody and they're not going to say anything to me, you know, but it really just knowing that people are, could do that, that information is just out there. It really is, a really kind of a sense of paranoia that like you really kind of personally kind of have to overcome because you can't think like that. You can't assume that, you know, random people know, like you just kind of have to live your life like nobody knows, until, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask, do you ever feel the pressure to sort of, preventatively come out to people in your life before they have a chance to discover it without you breaking the news first? I mean, is that kind of something
that
you deal with?
Yeah, I definitely do. I definitely do because, I mean, and it's because you don't want, I don't think that it's the first thing that people need to know about me, like personally, mm-hmm. you know, like, can you imagine like if it's like, and yeah, no, I want people to find out from me rather than finding out from the internet or whatever. But you also don't want to just tell people because, I mean, I've told people and then they've told me like, you really didn't need to tell me that.
Oh, ouch.
So you just get everything. And then you get people who, just think that is like you should just like literally just like every time you meet somebody, just like pass out a card that's got like all your and just tell people right away that it's just as like the first, because that's like the most important thing, you know, that to some people.
Right. There are some people who know you and they're like, well, why wouldn't you have told me this before?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Or just like, you know, you meet somebody like for the first time or whatever, and they just, you know, it's so it's just as whatever. But, you know, there's nothing, you know, I really try to focus on, I can just only control what I can control. And that's, I think, part of the hard part. And I would imagine other people struggle with too, is that you lose just like so much control over your life and for just a myriad of just varying reasons. So you just lose a lot of control and it's hard just kind of like letting go and just, you know, not worrying about it so much. And just kind of, you kind of just got to go with the flow because you never know what's going to happen next kind of. And, you know, if I've had random kind of, you know, where, you know, the uprootingness and kind of having to like the feeling of like having to start over like that, you know, you don't just get one of those with like a felony conviction and a registrant status. You know, it's like you're constantly just at the mercy of other forces.
Yeah. Yeah, that is an exercise in letting go, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Like accepting this very altered way of life for the next, I don't know, 20, 25 years. How often are people most commonly registered?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, no, and for life, I mean, it's a lot of things.
Yeah.
I'm actually thinking right now, I wasn't going to do this, but there's a quote in another book I thought I might read now that we're talking about this, if you wanted to add it.
That would be great. I would love it.
Okay. So this is a quote from a book called The Fall by Albert Camus. And it's about a defense attorney who's just kind of sitting at a bar drinking, and you're this person who's kind of sitting next to him. And he's just kind of telling you all about his ideas about crime and sort of how we think about crime. And he says, have you heard of the spitting cell, which a nation recently thought up to prove itself the greatest on earth? A walled-up box in which the prisoner can stand without moving. The solid door that locks him in his cement shell stops him at chin level. Hence, only his face is visible, and every passing jailer spits copiously on it. The prisoner, wedged into his cell, cannot wipe his face, though he is allowed, it is true, to close his eyes. Well, that, my friend, is a human invention. And this was written in like the 1950s, I think, 40s or 50s. And it really speaks to, I think, this idea that we have of identifying these bad people and just doing really cruel things to them publicly. You know, you spit on this person, you know, they can't wipe their face, but they can close their eyes, you know? And at the point he's trying to make when he says it's a human invention is that we did that. You know what I mean? Like we thought it up, and it's not for safety, it's not for punishment. You know, he says it's to prove like how powerful of a nation they are, you know, that they thought up this new invention of what to do with these criminals that we've identified. And this feels like the sex offender registry, it feels like that's kind of what he's talking about, you know, something that, you know, you can predict these things. This is what, you know, nations or, you know, communities, societies do, is that we identify people and then publicly punish them. And I think, you know, he's trying to make the point that that makes us feel good about ourselves. You know, we're not guilty. We're not any of the guilty ones. We're the innocents. Here's a guilty person, you know, and as part of their punishment, we're gonna humiliate them.
Right.
And so this is a very old sort of desire that we were kind of talking about before, and it just manifests itself in all these different ways. And I think that you can kind of draw a line historically through, you know, someone, you know, putting someone in the stocks and throwing fruit at them. You know, or you know, there's very public, you know, public executions, and so you can kind of draw a line through our desires and the ideas that we come up with to solve. You know, the spitting cell image that Camus was talking about, it's not solving anything.
Yeah.
It's not solving a problem. The problem that it's solved, and a crime problem, the problem that it's solving is, making people feel that we are doing something about it, as opposed to actually doing something about the
Right.
problems.
A sense of satisfaction. A sense of
Safety, too. I mean, that's
safety.
a,
Yeah.
yeah.
Well, I think that is a beautiful way to close this episode. I really do. I love opening and closing with quotes, and I think that one is really powerful, and thank you for sharing it.
Absolutely. A good book. He's a good, very good philosopher. He writes lots of good, interesting stories that lot of good things to think about, especially in my view, his sort of legal sort of and criminal sort of ideas. Really interesting.
And this is called The Fall. Okay. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about the Registry Drawn and for opening up about your personal experience and sharing that lovely quote with us. I think that it has hopefully informed
I don't know if I call it lovely. It's kind of scary.
that thoughtful, that
Yeah.
thought-provoking quote with us.
Sure.
Yeah. All right, I'll go with
I like
that.
that.
Okay.
Well, thanks for having me, Chelsea. I really do appreciate it. And I'm really thankful for all the listeners too who are thinking about things with open minds or and trying to think about these things in really difficult ways because it's really hard to think about. And it's just as important that we be thoughtful, I think, about what we're trying to do, even though it's hard, especially because it's so difficult and important.
Yeah, absolutely. a lot of these conversations are highly uncomfortable, but I think they're vital. And unless we are willing to breach that discomfort when we're talking about these issues, then we're not going to reach a place of better understanding, or we're not going to find solutions together.
Yep, I think you might be right.
Thanks to everyone listening. On Wednesday, Riley Page undergoes her cross-examination. We'll see you in 2 days.